Very good, so we continue to see final talk of the city question.
Okay. So I have a feeling that I somewhat lost you. I want to emphasize two things. First of all, everything that I've done is really extremely easy. And secondly, it's extremely useful. I mean, we've actually achieved a great deal, and it was very easy. So why easy? So basically, each of these things is a code for some commutation relation. You know, you write a certain exponential with the W's before the U's, it's equal to some other exponential with the U's before the W's. So everything here is a code for some commutation relation, and it's a bit hard to read the code because you have to get used to the language, and unfortunately you have to get used to the language, but really these are just codes for commutation relations. And secondly, these commutation relations are extremely easy. Each one of them is proven, each one of them involves only two of my three variables, so each one of them happens either in a two-dimensional, the 2D algebra, where everything is extremely simple, or in the Heisenberg algebra, where everything is also simple and also familiar. So really, everything here is very easy once you get... if you go over it again at home and ask yourself, what does each one of these mean? They mean simple things, and you can compute them with 2x2 matrices. They really are all very simple-minded. And second, we've achieved a great deal. So, let me say two things about it. One, so everything ends up written in terms of quadratics. So you may think, oh my God, these are complicated formulas, okay? But they're actually tiny. So, if you have a tangle with n strands, then if you look at traditional quantum invariant techniques, you're going to look at some representation. If you're lucky, and it's the Jones polynomial, then it's two-dimensional, but in general it will be some possibly high-dimensional representation of some quantum group. And you're going to raise it to the nth power. Right? So even if it's the two-dimensional representation raised to the nth power, your invariant will involve 2 to the n coefficients. Okay? Now, here, we're talking about quadratics in n variables. The variables correspond to the strands of the tangle. So, we're talking about, well, quadratics are the same as matrices, so we're talking about n squared coefficients instead of 2 to the n. This is tiny. It's really, really, really small. It's really way more efficient. It's just incomparably more efficient than standard quantum algebra. So the coefficients of the quadratics are polynomials, are functions, at the moment still functions, later they will become polynomials, in the b's and the e to the b's. But that's comparable to the fact that the coefficients in quantum algebra are functions of q. Okay? So we still beat quantum algebra by a huge margin. Okay? So that's one point. And the other point is that we are done. Okay? And there is something sneaky about it. So let's look at number 6. I have told you how to switch a WU order to a UW order if your starting thing is quadratic in these two variables that appear here, u and w, and then linear also in these two variables. Okay? But that's actually not what I want. What I want in general is to switch wu to uw, where the thing that appears here is a general quadratic in many variables, among which is my W and my U. Okay? So it appears as if this is not what I want. But in fact, it is exactly, it has in it what I want. Because you see, if I have a general quadratic in which some u and some w appear, so it can always be written on the, of the form, so right, so I have a general quadratic of the form sum beta ij ui wj. Again, I'm talking only about balanced quadratics, same number of u's as w's. So if I have a quadratic like that, and I want to manage, I want to switch over a w3 over a u7, which appear in the wrong order. So I can always write it as some coefficient times, what did I say? W3 U7, I hope that's what I said. Okay? And then there will be some other coefficient times W3 and some other coefficient times U7, where this coefficient contains other U's. Okay, so this alpha here is really a big linear combination of other U's. So it has in it more U's. And this coefficient has more W's. And then plus the rest, and the rest contains no W3s and no U7s. So the rest is just neutral. The rest doesn't care at all how I order U3 and W7, so it's a factor that you can copy from the left to the right. It doesn't matter. Okay? The thing that appears here right now is very similar to the formula that appears here, except when I wrote these formulas, I told you delta, alpha, and betas, and beta should be scalars. And when I proved these formulas, alpha, beta, and delta were scalars. And when I use the formula, delta will indeed be a scalar, but alpha and betas will not be scalars. They will contain more U's and more W's. Okay? Other U's and other W's. But these other U's and other W's, for the purpose of our computation, where I switch W3 and U7, are commuting variables. Say, you know, they get normal order, so in my ordering, I have W3 here and U7 here, and I want to switch the ordering. The other U's are placed here, the other W's are placed here, or maybe here, or maybe here, I don't care. They're placed somewhere else, and they can be regarded as commuting variables. Or if you wish, I can do the, I suppose it's called Fubini's theorem. Right, when you right, this is sort of an, this O is sort of an analog of integration, right? It has dummy variables and later, and I'm integrating quadratics like Gaussian integration. It's kind of like integration, and in integration, you can first integrate with respect to some variables and then with respect to the rest. And similarly here, I can declare that I first place the W's and the U's, and then place all the other variables. So if you wish, I can place all the other things later. And at the time when I'm doing this computation, they're still in the symmetric algebra, they're still commuting. So they're still coefficients. So this formula holds just as well if alpha contains further U's and beta contains further W's. So, and these other U's and other W's appear in the specification here far away, elsewhere. So this is completely general. This does everything we want.
Sorry. occurs it, so this was this is this big lambda for G0.
Yeah.
But this is supposed to work in G1.
No, but G1 comes in 15 minutes, not yet.
Okay.
Okay? I'm still doing the warm-up.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay? But I claim that, first of all, everything is really, really easy, except for getting used to the language. And you know, we've gotten used to the language of representation theory a long time ago, but it's not any more confusing or less confusing. This is easy. Okay? And second, we're done. Okay? And in fact, as I mentioned, here's the implementation. So I haven't discussed the remaining implementation thing. So how do you normal order a WU? Well, you copy the formula from the previous page, along with the quadratic where you set the things that the wi and the uj that you're trying to commute to zero. And then you take this formula, and in it you substitute nu is equal to 1 plus b delta inverse, and alpha is the cofactor of wi in the quadratic, so it's the derivative of the quadratic with respect to wi, except I don't want this term inside alpha, because I want to have a special name for it, so I set uj to 0. Beta is likewise, and delta is the second derivative with respect to uj of, and wi of the quadratic, and this is it. That's the full complete implementation. Okay, well, there is one further thing that we need to do. What did I do? Oh, you know, maybe I'll skip it. I wanted to show... So for the specific tangles that we were working with, some further normal ordering. So you want to move W1 across W2, and you get some big mess, but it's a big mess which is really a quadratic formula, like here's the coefficient of U1, W1, and it's some function of the B's and their exponentials. So I just wanted you to see what it looks like, but maybe we should not look at the details. And then there is one further thing that I need to do. Remember that at the end, my goal was to tell you how to do strand stitching in a tangle. So if you have a tangle, you have an element of G, U of G written here, and another element of U of G written here. Let's say that this one is written upwards and this one is written downwards, just to make it easy. I want to tell you how to stitch. I want to tell you how to connect the two. So I've brought this form, this tangle already, or not the invariant, the partition function of this tangle already to canonical form. So to CAL form, so CUW and CUW. Sorry, CUW. And now I stitch them, so I have two CALs along one strand, and I want to rewrite it in the form of a single CAL. So like the, what is it called? Barak-Tarski paradox? I want to convert two cows into one. So what do? Well, I switch a W across a C. Then I... Well, okay, actually it's written here. So I have two cows. What do? I switch the W across a C using the NWC operator. Then... In fact, I can do two things at the same time, it doesn't matter in which order I do them. I switch the C across the U and the W across the U. Again, this was low cost, this was complicated, but, well, I do them. Then I get C, C, U, U, W, W, and I just need to merge. And merging was the first thing I did, so these are these merging operators, and I'm done. Okay? So here is the implementation. So the merging I didn't even bother to implement, so I do it by hand. It's this map all C's to CK, all W's to WK, all everything else to WK, basically. But the content here is switch W with C, switch U with C, switch W with U. And the combination of these three switches is
the stitching operator.
So now it's implemented and I can start using it. So first of all, for this tangle, I need to basically, I just need to stitch 1 and 2 on one strand and then 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 on the other. So I take T00, which we've already computed. This is the base value before doing any simplifications. Then I stitch 1 and 2 into 1, 3 and 4 into 3, 3 and 5 into 3, 3 and 6 into 3. So 3, 4, 5, and 6 got stitched into 3. And the result is this, and this is the invariant of the tangle I started from. Completely, fully implemented. But you know, once I have a complete program, I can use it to verify that everything, that it's consistent, okay? So, you know, maybe I didn't had a typo somewhere, maybe I had a sign mistake somewhere. And in fact, believe me, I had infinitely many typos and infinitely many sign mistakes before it stabilized. Okay, not infinitely, but a large finite number. So, for example, one thing that we want to check is to check the meta-associativity of stitching, right? So, remind you, like if I stitch three things, if I stitch them first these two and then into this, or first these two and then into that, I should get the same answer. So I let Q0 be a general quadratic with an undetermined coefficients. So Fij, Ui, Wj, and Fici, I didn't even bother to tell you that the Fis should be linear and the Bs, but because everything still works even if I don't tell you. So I look at Q0, so I look at a completely general quadratic, this is Q0, and I feed it into stitch 1 and 2 into 1, and then 1 and 3 into 1, and check if it's equal to the other order of stitching, you know, hit enter, and my computer produces true. And of course it doesn't, it only does so after the 20th iteration, but I'm already past the 20th iteration. Okay. Next, I can test Rademeister 3. So I didn't put a picture of Rademeister 3, but Rademeister 3 involves what? The left-hand side is something like this, the right-hand side is something like that. So basically these are three crossings stitched in one way, or the same three crossings stitched in some other way. So here is the left-hand side, I call it T1, three crossings stitched in one way, compute the invariant, you get this. The same three crossings stitched in some other way, and check if it's equal to T1, the answer is true. So everything works. And then, as a last example, now suppose I wanted to compute the invariant of some large knot, and for me some large knot always means the same thing, 8, 17. I don't know, that's what I always do. So 8, 17 is this knot, which is really made of, what, 8 crossings, and I sort of number everything, and here are the, I need to, and here's what I need to stitch. So first of all, Z1 is the kind of before the stitching, just the product of the crossings. So you have a negative crossings where 12 goes over 1, negative crossing where 12 goes over 1, times a negative crossing where 2 goes over 7, and so on. And then I have a loop where I take Z1, or where I set Z1 to be Z1, where I stitch 1 and n into 1, where n runs from 2 to 16. Okay? And furthermore, I set all the b variables to be the same. Okay? Because at the end they become the same. So. Okay, I just reduced the number of subscripts, if you wish. So let's compute the result. The result is something not interesting in the numerator divided by a coefficient, so the prefactor. The prefactor is something which you can recognize if you compare this to this. So I also printed the built-in, the the value of the Alexander polynomial from some database that pre-exists. So you can check that the denominator, so omega, the coefficient, is 1 over the Alexander polynomial written in exponential variables. And that's the end of the G0 story. Okay? So again, you have to get used to it, but it's really not that hard. Okay? So the key to the G0 story was the big G0 lemma, and now I need to tell you what the big G1 lemma is. Okay? Now, in the basically, but what I cared about is the big G0 lemma was really 1, 2, and 6. 3, 4, and 5 were sort of sublemmas in order to get 6. Okay? So, I need to tell you, 1, 2, and 6. Now, 1 and 2 remain exactly the same. Because 1 is just nothing. 1 is true for any algebra always. It's just merging things that are the same. 2 is the same for G0 as for G1. Because if you compare the commutation relations in G0 and G1, they're just the same for the UC pair and for the WC pair. They don't change, so this doesn't change. The only thing to do is 6. Okay? So here is 6. So 6 becomes, so again, now I'm in G1. So if you order a quadratic, this is the same as before. This is quadratic and these two are linear, but I should be thinking of alpha as if it contains more U's and beta as if it contains more W's. So this is really a balanced quadratic in the U's and the W. So if you reorder a quadratic an exponentiated quadratic from the WU variables, from the WU order to the CUW order, maybe I should remind you that the commutation relation of U and W, which before was just B, now include twice epsilon C, or maybe it was minus two epsilon C? It's in on the handout somewhere. Whatever. Okay? So, when I will be commuting U's and W's, I will not only be producing scalars, but also epsilon times C's. So, if I want to write the answer will be written in terms of C's and U's and W's. So, I need to write, so the whole cow will appear on the right. Okay? And the claim is that what you get is the same as before, except with an additional epsilon nu lambda term. The nu is just a factor, ignore it. But lambda is some awful polynomial which contains in it, maybe it's awful, but just look at it a little bit. It's just a polynomial in the coefficients that appear here, so alpha, beta, and lambda, and also nu, but nu is just as before, it's just a combination, something that's written in terms of delta, it's 1 plus b delta inverse, or something like that. And it also contains some further u's and w's, and some further C's occasionally. Here is a C. There should be some more C's. Here's another C. I don't know. Maybe that's all. No, I think there are some more C's that I can't find. Okay? So we, Roland and I, call this the logos. So logos is Greek for principle of order and knowledge. And basically, Lambda contains in it everything you need to know. The only thing that we were missing about G1. So same relation as before plus epsilon times some mess. But this mess contains in it all the commutation relations that you will need for G1. Okay? Maybe one more comment. So this lambda, the logos, is a quartic polynomial, a balanced quartic in, well, the interesting things is in alpha, beta, u, and w. So balanced means the same number of u's and w's in every term. And quartic means that the highest degree is 4. Okay? So, now, you can look at this term and complain that it doesn't have the same number of u and w's, but it does, because beta really contains, right, beta is the prefactor of u, and it really is a combination of w's. So this is a balanced quartic of in u and w's, in the u's and the w's. And when I say quartic, I mean up to quartic. So this is a quartic term, this is a degree 4 term, but if you stare at it for a while, you'll probably find terms that are only degree 2, and also some constant terms. So terms that are of just constants. Okay? Good. So now I need to prove it, and here's the proof. I did introduce myself at the beginning of this lecture series as a brute, and that's one place where you see it. But the proof is a brutal hell, but it's a doable brutal hell. The techniques that I mentioned more or less work. So you have to do things like commute a long string of W's across a long string of U's. And what I mean by that is this is a piece that appears within an exponential, and this is a piece that appears within some other exponential, or the same exponential. I mean, if it's, you have to commute such things across each other. So you have to pass the U's over the W's. And every time you pass a U across a W, so I mean you take this U and you pass it, you sort of slide it in, and at some point it gets to be here, and now you want to pass it across the next W, and the commutator before was just a B, which you could pull out. And then the combinatorics was easy. Now, it may also contain an epsilon c. Okay? And now you have to pull this, so the new terms will always contain an epsilon in them. And now you have to still move the c's all the way to the left so as to bring it to Cal form. And you have to count how many w's are left, so the combinatorics get more complicated. But commuting C's across W's is still relatively easy, and the combinatorics just still involves binomial coefficients if Z's were N and M, then binomial coefficients and polynomials in N and M. So things that if you're good with combinatorics, you know how to do them. There is also the scattering glow technique that I didn't mention that still works here, but is also somewhat harder, but is also somewhat hard. And then there is the truth. And the truth is, I did it really brute force. I mean, I knew there has to be some polynomial. Basically, by looking at what you might get by doing all of these things, you realize that the result has to be a quartic, that you should be able to write the results in terms of a quartic polynomial. The only question is, what is this quartic polynomial? You feed it into the computer, you compute everything to degree 14, I think that's how far as we went. You first have to implement some program, you first have to write a program that does computations in the universal enveloping algebra of G1. That's not the same program as the program that I've shown you, that's another one, right? But you write that program, you feed this in, you figure out the coefficients, and you forget it. Sorry. Okay? Okay. Oops, that stopped working again. But then we have a problem. Because, you see, before, I just needed to tell you how to normal order exponentials. Right? I had things of the form... some ordering of an exponential of a quadratic, and again I split the quadratic into two pieces, but one is quadratic in B and C and one is quadratic in U and W, but I have to tell you how to switch things like that from the order WU to the order UW. But now my big G1 lemma, so after I've commuted things the first time, my big G1 lemma will introduce polynomial prefactors. So now, next time I will want to commute things, I will have a polynomial prefactor here, where P is some, at most, balanced quartic polynomial. So I need to know how to commute things that have a polynomial prefactor. And that's the next time, the next place where I use techniques from quantum field theory. Except it's not at all related to quantum field theory. So in quantum field theory, you first learn how to integrate Gaussians, and then you ask yourself, okay, how do I integrate perturbed Gaussians? So a Gaussian with a polynomial prefactor. And the answer is, well, just what is written here. Namely, so if I want to reorder a polynomial, so the two relevant variables for this example are just C and U, so if I want to order a polynomial in C, reorder a polynomial in C and U times a Gaussian times an exponential, I notice that I can rewrite this polynomial as a differential operator acting on the exponential. So, right, if you differentiate the exponential with respect to gamma, it just pulls out a factor of C. And if you differentiate with respect to beta, it pulls out a factor of U. So if you apply a differential, so basically if you turn this polynomial into a differential operator by replacing every C by D to D gamma and every U by D to D beta, then applying this operator to this exponential will give you the same exponential but with a prefactor, which is this polynomial. Okay? But now, this is differentiation with respect to a variable that is not one of the integration variables. Okay? That is inert in as much as the reordering is concerned. So I can pull this differential operator outside of the integral, compute the integral, get the same answer as before, and then pull it back in. And now, if I want to know how to write this thing in the order you see, if I want to rewrite it in the order CU, I just take this formula and differentiate it according to P. Okay? So again, completely standard technique from quantum field theory used completely in the wrong place. but still correct. Okay? And likewise, if you want to write a woo as a cow, you take this polynomial in U and W, and well, it's exactly the same. Okay? I suppose this is the only part of the program that that does not look like the mathematics. So the rest of the program looks exactly like the mathematics. But this small part of the program is sort of technical. Namely, Mathematica doesn't have a built-in way of turning polynomials into differential operators, of substituting into a variable a differentiation. Okay? So I had to implement it. So I basically had to tell Mathematica how to turn P into what I call a differential polynomial by substituting a variable x to the derivative with respect to alpha and a variable y into the derivative with respect to beta. So this just means compute p at d alpha d beta and evaluate it on the function f, and there's no way for you to understand this piece of code without reading the manual, the Mathematica manual. Other than that, so after this is implemented, everything completely makes sense, except there are a few things to worry about. First of all, the stitching is slightly more complicated. So before the stitching, right, if you sorted two cows, right, you had to switch this across this. Here at some point you have to switch a W across a U, and a new C will be created, which you'll have to put in order. But it works. But the operators I have can still do it. So there is one extra stitch, one extra step in the stitching, in the sorting of cows. And then the last technical bit is that I have to tell you what are the values of the crossings. Oh, and I forgot, I should have mentioned it before. In general, in quantum algebra, in such this kind of invariance, you have a value for each crossing, but there is also some correction terms that you need to put in the caps and the cups. So in the wherever you have a cap or a cup, in the knot projection, you have to put some correction term in. And I forgot to mention it, and the reason was that for G0, they are irrelevant. For G0, they commute with everything, you can ignore them. But for G1, they no longer are irrelevant. So I need to tell you what are the value of the overcrossing, the undercrossing, the N right, N left, U right, and U left, where N right is a cup that looks like an N with the orientation to the right, N left is this, U right is this, and U left is this. So, how did I find these values? So, the answer is that, again, this is brute force. So, once you have the algebra, and you know what equations the values have to satisfy, namely Rademeister 3 moves and then some minor relations involving the cups and the caps. I will show you one of them later. You can just brute force it. You can just say, let's guess the value, put the value with undetermined coefficients, and then try to solve the equations. So basically, this was found by brute force. And there isn't a unique solution. So I found one solution, and there might be many. No, not there might be. There are many more. In fact, I found the most general solution. and there are many free parameters in it. Okay. And then finally, and I'm sorry, this is now I'm stretching your ability to follow, I'm sorry. Finally, there are some pragmatic simplifications. So, pragmatic, I mean, at the level that I've described the theory, I have no explanation for them, but they make life easier if you do them. Okay? So, if you look at the formula for the R matrix, it involves e to the b minus 1 over b. And it's nice to get rid of it. So it and this means that there will be lots of e to the b's minus over b in many of the formulas that follows. So you set zeta to be e to the b, minus 1 over b, and then you can get rid of many of these factors by rescaling u to be u bar, which is zeta u. And then you correspondingly, beta is sort of the cofactor that multiplies u in many places. So you have to rescale beta in the opposite way, and then delta gets rescaled, and then epsilon, you might want to rescale epsilon in the same way too. And then you simplify things, so after you do that, you no longer have b's anywhere, you still have e to the b's. So you simplify things by calling e to the b t. So then nu becomes nu bar, and instead of whatever it was before, it becomes 1 plus t minus 1 delta inverse. Then you get thoroughly confused by, this is always, when you change variables, you always at the end name the variables the same way as you named the previous variables. And then you get thoroughly confused. So you do this here too. So you forget the bars over the new variables and get thoroughly confused. And then you get even more confused by replacing, by calling nu inverse mu. And finally, after you do all of that, you find that the the things that you get, so the things that you get are scalars plus epsilon times a polynomial times an exponential of a quadratic. But you find that the quadratic always have a W inverse term in it, so it's nice to factor it out. The scalar or the polynomial always have an omega to the minus 5 factor in it, so it's nice to factor it out. And when you're done, so it's nice to rename this whole expression written here, E of omega L, Q, and P. But again, in principle, it's the same thing. I'm only changing variables to variables in which everything appears simpler or comes out simpler. And when you're done doing all of this, all the coefficients, instead of being arbitrary rational functions in e to the b and b, are now just polynomial, Laurent polynomials in the t's. And that was the purpose of all of these crazy changes of variables. So, again, at this point, you should have lost me. And I've lost myself. I mean, I get extremely confused when I do this. Okay, I mean, but I just, you know, okay, you just do it. So in the new variables, the logos becomes a slightly different form, but it's the same logos, it's just a different formula for it in the new variables. And here it is, but now it's written like a part of a computer program. And then, these are the results for the generators. So the positive crossing now is prefactor 1, BICJ, UIWJ. So this is the L part, this is the W, the Q part, and before the Q part had a prefactor like this, but now I've eliminated it, so it's even simpler. And then this is the polynomial part, this is the part proportional to epsilon, the next four lines. And again, that was found by brute force.
But if you look at it, it's just a quartic polynomial in balanced quartic polynomials in the UIs and the WJs. So it's not so hard. Here is this. This is the inverse of that, and these are the values of the cups and the cups, the UR, NR, UL, NL. Okay? And finally, this is the complete program. Sorry, so these are some utilities, and this is the complete program. And by now it's a bit hard to recognize, but the basic point is remains the same. If you want to switch a W over U, you write Q to be this quadratic. This quadratic is the quadratic that appears in the exponential in the big G1 lemma. Okay? And then at some point, you exponentiate this quadratic, you apply a differential polynomial to it, you multiply by the inverse of the quadratic to basically kill it to and be left with just the coefficient, and that becomes the coefficient of the new of the result after the switch. So again, it's confusing, but it's still basic at the end. And then stitching, as I said, is the same stitching as before, but with one extra step. And now I can do computations. So only two computations I will show you, and then I'll switch to discussion. So first of all, I mentioned that there was the Rademeister 3, which of course I have to check again, but I will not check it because it's the same check, and the answer is the same answer, namely true. But there are some new checks, like there is this Swirl equation. Here are two ways of using, so these two things are equivalent, are the same topologically, but there are different combinations of cups and cups and a crossing. Okay? So you have to check that if you take a crossing and add some cups and cups to it and do some stitching, or sort of the same thing but different kind of stitching, so basically you have to check that the two things give the same answer. So this is what the left hand side gives. You compare it with the right hand side, the computer outputs true, which means that things work. And then here is the trefoil, but now I have to be careful. I need to use the zero framed trefoil. So basically, if you haven't seen knot theory before, ignore it. If you've seen knot theory, I have to add a few kinks to make it unframed. So I'm adding three kinks to deframe, to make it zero framing. And then it becomes much more complex. Then it's not just three crossings, it has six crossings, and God knows how many cups and cups. So I write this big combination of crossings and cups and do all the stitchings and get a crazy result as the answer. And then the next line is just some mathematical simplification. I'm just simplifying this to some form which will be nicer. This is equal to that. I'm just simplify it, just present it differently. And this is the invariant of the trefoil. So it's some Laurent polynomial times C times another Laurent polynomial. Sorry, this is the epsilon part, the new part, the part which was not seen in G0. So some Laurent polynomial times another Laurent polynomial multiplying C, and finally another Laurent polynomial multiplying UW. Now, you can ask me, so why did I stop at the trefoil? And the answer is, this was done a week ago, and a week ago I decided this is the time to stop making progress and start preparing a talk. I don't know if the preparation went well, but I did my best. Okay? And I want to, oh, yeah, I think I want to, yeah, I have 10 minutes left and I'd rather not do the complexity estimate, but rather talk about my to-do list and my question list. But very roughly, in the complexity estimate, the main difficulty comes because P is a quartic polynomial. A quartic polynomial has, in n variables, if you have n strands and you have actually 3n variables, but it's the same. So a quartic polynomial in n variables has roughly n to the 4 coefficients. This is still a lot less than 4 to the n that you would get in representation theory. Okay? But when you compute everything and introduce the width of a knot, and it doesn't matter what this is right now, you find that the complexity, the rough complexity estimate for this invariant is that, well, assuming standard conjectures, it's n to the 5, and not assuming these conjectures, it's at most n to the 7. Okay? So it's still within my paradise. And I think the conjectures are pretty safe. So it's roughly n to the 5, the complexity. N being the number of crossings of a net. Okay, and now my to-do list. It's long one. So clean up and write up, obviously. Implement well. So the implementations that I've shown you were demo implementations. They were meant to show that it works and to produce tiny results, but they will completely crash if you do anything big. So, so implement well. It's actually not obvious that our quantities are polynomials and not rational functions. The formulas do involve rational functions, but somehow, at the end, you're only left with polynomials. The formulas do involve division. There is this new inverse in various places. So it's not fully understood why, at the end, you only get polynomials, but you do. So to really get the complexity estimates well, you need bounds on the degrees of these polynomials. And I have bounds. And they come from a different place. I don't have bounds that are intrinsic to this description. So it would be nice to have bounds on the degrees. Okay, and then come more questions. So what about links? I only told you about closed components, right? I only told you about how to work in the universal enveloping algebra. If you close a component, you get things in the co-invariance of the universal enveloping algebra. I have no idea how to manage such things. My language doesn't do it. Okay? It's unnecessary, right? If you want a knot invariant, you just take a long knot. If you want the application to ribbon knots, the application was written in terms of tangles with no closed components. But, well, it would be nice to have more and actually have invariants of links. I don't know what to do. Fully digest the expansion theorem? What was the expansion theorem? Did I state an expansion theorem? Oh, I think I know what it is. But possibly I forgot to highlight it. Yeah, I forgot to put it. I forgot to put the slide. Yeah, so I should have mentioned that all of this is expected to be very strongly expected. There is very strong evidence to be readable from the Collard-Jones polynomial. Now, so you can say, oh, well, we know Collard-Jones polynomial since we were little babies. But that's nonsense, because nobody can compute the Collard-Jones polynomial.
So it's completely wrong to say, to think we knew it all along, okay? It's the wrong way to view it. But nevertheless, it would be nice to prove this theorem, right? It's, you know, the best theorems are theorems that say A and B is equal to B, where both A and B are computable. Less good theorems are to say that C is equal to D, or where C and D are not computable. So this is half-good theorem. It's a theorem about A is equal to C, so something computable is equal to something not computable. So the statement is that the computable thing that I've just mentioned can be read off from the Kolar-Jones polynomial, which is not computable. But how? So the Kolar-Jones polynomial can be expanded. So it's a function of two variables. One is, when you write Q as e to the h, an expanding power of h, and the other is the dimension of the representation. So if you write it as a power series in these two variables, you get an array of coefficients, and then there is a theorem that this array of coefficients has zeros below the diagonal, one over the Alexander polynomial on the diagonal, and above the diagonal is where I expect to see the new stuff. So prove it. Okay? So, by the way, this sort of suggests that the new stuff is sort of a minor perturbation of the Alexander polynomial. And, well, there are many other reasons to think it's a minor perturbation of the Alexander polynomial. Well, not minor in the sense, but it's new. It really is. I can prove that it genuinely is new, that it contains more information than the Alexander polynomial. Okay? Or if, I don't know if more is the right word, but it contains information that the Alexander polynomial does not contain. But it's still a perturbation of the Alexander polynomial, which suggests that there should be... Now, the Alexander polynomial is something that has very deep topological, you know, interpretations, understanding. So this suggests that the new stuff should also have deep topological interpretations. Where am I? Oh, I went way past, sorry. Yeah. So one of the other projects is to try to understand everything that I said in a topological language. Okay, next. So I told you that R was not canonical. Okay? So you can say that the invariant is therefore not canonical. So this is actually too good to be true. You know, suppose the invariant genuinely depended on R. Then it means that for any choice of R, you get a polynomial time computable invariant. Instead of just, you know, getting, you know, $1 million at the casino, you get a whole flood of bills of millions of dollars. It's too much. So therefore, it must be that the result depends on R in some completely predictable way. But I don't know why. I don't know how. Okay? Next, is there a canonical R? So what I did is I found the most general possible R, and it had many, many undetermined coefficients, and then I've set them to be zero or small, simple-minded things so as to get the result to appear as simple as possible. But that's, you know, that's brute. That's being a brute. So is there a canonical R? So Roland has a different view of G1. So a different version of G1, if you wish, which is more inspired by quantum SL2 as opposed to ordinary SL2. And then he gets simpler R's, possibly canonical, but he still does some non-canonical steps along the way. So it's possibly simpler R's, but not fully understood. At least I don't fully understand
understand it. And but on the other hand, his logos is much more complicated. So I don't know what to say. Well, maybe I'll skip the next one in the interest of time. Okay, in knot theory you can also remove strands, and I didn't tell you how to do it in this formalism, and more interestingly, you can double strands, which corresponds to the co-product of the universal enveloping algebra. I told you how to do products, not how to do co-products. So that's something to work out. It should work, likewise the antipode. It should work, but I didn't write anything. Once you understand strand doubling, you can say something not only about ribbon knots, but also about the genus of knots. So there is a potential further topological implication, and, well, say something. Then, well, you know, the Kashiwara-Verne thing, at least in my language, involves finding a value for a vertex, instead of knotted graphs, and then you can, you know, knot things that also have vertices in them. And the value of the vertex is somehow the Kashiwara-Verne thing. So the equations make sense and are not solved in this context. So it's kind of like, it's hard to say anymore if it's the Alexeyev Tolosiev of Kashiwara-Verne vertex or if it's the Epping of Kashdan vertex, but it's still a vertex. In general, this is a language in which you can write the equations for associators and for braiders. I never mentioned what braiders are, but Travis will tomorrow. So you can use this as a playground to study associators and braiders. So, what is an associator in this language, or projected to this language? Well, restating to topological language, I already mentioned. Well, this everything, all of this reduces to representations of the braid group. I mean, if you restrict your tangles to be braids, you get relatively simple representations of the braid groups, and I've written them elsewhere, but not here. And they're really simple. They're really, really simple representations of the braid group, and for all I know, they're new. Nobody ever studied them, so study them. There is an involution between B plus and B minus, and I don't understand it, and it should be related to mirror images of knots, and I don't understand how. There is, well, ribbon knots. I actually never made precise the relationship with gamma calculus, which I introduced in the beginning, so one has to do it. Relate to the Jones polynomial, oh, I think this is a repetition of this. Okay, sorry. Relate with ordinary Q algebra, this is sort of what Roland is doing. And you know, when I learned to juggle, when I was learning to juggle 3, it's very hard against this projector light. Somebody warned me never to learn to juggle 4, because the moment you learn to juggle 4, people ask you, can you juggle 5? Okay? So, this warning should apply here. Because you can ask me, okay, so I did 1 smidgen SL2, you can ask me, can you do K smidgen SLN? And the answer is, maybe you can. I think there ought to be lovely theorems to prove there. In principle, basically all you have to do is take the, you know, semi-simple algebra, look at its upper Borel, take the standard co-bracket, multiply it by epsilon, where epsilon to the k plus 1 is equal to 0, and you've gotten k plus 1 smidgen SLN, or k plus 1 smidgen, k smidgen G, where G is an arbitrary semi-simple algebra. But then does everything else work? Or how does everything else work? What exactly are the... Well, in principle, one could work out all of this. It's not going to be me, because I stop at juggling four balls. And actually, there is another reason. I mean, it will become less and less polynomial. So, I think there ought to be beautiful mathematics hiding there, but for my purposes, I want to stay low.
Okay.
Maybe there are other such things. I mean, maybe there are other solvable situations, not necessarily coming from solvable approximations of semi-simple algebras. I don't know. And finally, this is sort of mandatory. So every talk in knot theory where you introduce an invariant must end with, can you categorify this invariant? So I'll end with that. And also with my usual proper number.
Again, so you, what are the main like topological or non-theoretic problems that you want to kind of, you have a new invariant, right? So you said this Riemann versus Schwarzschild, what are the other good candidates, or why this problem is a natural one, just because it's unsolved and it's a new invariant which can fix.
So Riemann equals slice is an old problem. I don't remember, I think it was maybe asked by Fox and Milner, or maybe by Fox. But basically, it's from probably the 60s. So it's an old problem, it would be nice to settle it. Mm-hmm. Determining knot genus is just sort of a challenge. You know, you draw a complicated knot, how do you figure its genus? I might be able to say something about it, just like the Alexander polynomial says something about it too. I think mostly it's not determined what it would do. In other words, so now you have something that you can compute to for huge knots, in principle. You'll stare at it for a long time, and either you'll find things to do with it or not. But at least you should be staring at it for a long time. At least if you're a knot theorist, you know, you're not obliged, personally. But if you're a knot theorist, and suddenly you have a new tool. So again, the Alexander polynomial is better than all this. But it existed for 90 years and it's been mined to exhaustion. Okay? Even though the formulas that I've presented are new and better than the formulas that were known before, it's in principle well mined. So now you have a new vein that wasn't studied. You go into this vein and you study it as much as you can. And potentially you'll get nothing.
And with present tools, you expect it would go to how many crossings? So you write this 100, or what are your expectations?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. It also depends on the power of your computer. It also, you know, depends on how much you're willing to wait. Mm-hmm. I don't know. The Alexander polynomial, which is roughly 1/4, can be computed in practice for knots with up to 1,000 crossings. Mm-hmm. Okay? So I don't know, I'll be happy if I can get to knots with 200 crossings. Mm-hmm. By the way, you know, I once had a conversation with a fellow from biology who looks at molecules, or maybe it was DNA or something, and wanted to determine whether something is knotted or not. And he wanted quick invariants that will compute it. And in fact, the crossing numbers he's looking at were way bigger. So there is market for fast computations.
So maybe you already said it, but what's the lowest size where Alexander don't distinguish and your invariant distinguishes?
I don't know.
I mean, I also said that I have not computed anything beyond the trefoil. I have the programs. It's a matter of typing in the knots. I made a deliberate decision a week ago to stop. So this is all very, very fresh. I mean, really, really, really fresh.
So, is it possible that it won't distinguish? No? Or that's not possible?
No, it's not possible. Because again, I know where this comes from within the Concievich integral, and within the Concievich integral it comes from a different place than the Alexander polynomial, and there are theorems that show that sort of if you look at different places they do different things. So on completely theoretical grounds I can prove that there are knots that have zero, that are not detected by the Alexander polynomial and that are detected by this.
Ooh, I'm lying.
Well, can you say a couple of words? You say, well, this could, what is this different place in Concievich?
So this is this should correspond to the two loop part of the Concievich integral, whereas the Alexander polynomial is the one loop part. Mm-hmm. Sorry, what I said was slightly imprecise, but it's still. You know, it's still clearly new. There's no way it could be contained in the Alexander polynomial just because it comes from a different place in the Concievich integral.
Right.
If not, Paul, thanks again.